Hi, and welcome to episode 102 of the Machine Ethics Podcast. This episode, we're chatting with Adir Ben Yehuda. This was recorded on the 16th of July, 2025. Adir and I talk about his company, Autonomy AI, AI automation for front-end web development, English as the new coding language, allowing an LLM to optimize itself, conversations around job displacement and my pessimism and his optimism, vibe coding, recent events like Grok self-identifying as Mecha Hitler, the ethics and guardrails of LLMs, and purposely trying to break a system, as well as being a plumber. If you like this episode, you can find more at machine-ethics.net. You can also contact us at hello@machine-ethics.net. You can follow us on Blue Sky, machine-ethics.net, Instagram, Machine Ethics Podcast, YouTube, @machine-ethics. And if you can, you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/machine-ethics. Thank you so much for listening and hope you enjoy. Hi, welcome to the podcast. Tell our listeners who you are and what do you do?
Yeah, so first of all, it's great to be here. I'm Adir Ben Yehuda. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Autonomy AI. And we build an autonomous R&D platform with the focus on autonomous front end. We help companies essentially accelerate their software development process.
Awesome. I always like hit this first intro and go, oh, there's loads of questions from that. But the first question we always ask on the podcast to our interviewees is, we have this word AI. What is that thing to you? What are we talking about, AI?
I think where AI is, at least the way I see it and the way I perceive it, is the ability for human beings to actually communicate with machines, right? With what we look today. So if up to date, like let's say a couple of years ago, people actually communicated with machines in a way, I ask you for a task and you provide some feedback, but it's not like back and forth, right? It's not a dialogue. AI kind of opened it to make it a smarter dialogue and have the ability for us humans, right? Essentially to ask for the machine to actually get back to us, but also challenging a few things. And if you look at a broader aspect of things, it's just an acceleration. It's basically taking all the bored things we hate, like the annoying things we hate, and kind of help us remove this with AI, do the back and forth there, and excel and accelerate in different aspects.
Awesome. So it's really interesting that you pick up on this kind of way we interface with computers, right? Yeah. Like if I've got this kind of almost like a dream, right, that in the future, you know, we don't have keyboards, right? We're not like tapping away at keyboards on the screen. We might be chatting. And I don't know if you saw the rabbit, was it last year or 2 years ago, that kind of completely tanked. But the idea around that was like, you have this thing and you talk to it and it takes pictures, but you don't, and that's your interface, right? Is that kind of like part of that vision, do you think, that we go head towards this like more kind of free flowing audio kind of being vocal and interfacing that way or in a different way completely?
I mean, I think absolutely. And also, if you think about it, right, let's think about a couple of things here. If you look at the initial products in AI, the naming was Copilot, right? So it's like, I think it's all in the name, first of all. That's the first thing. If you in the listeners here probably have all tried to talk with ChatGPT, it's a lovely conversation. I mean, all the nuances, right? Mm-hmm. And the little giggles. So first of all, it's like it creates a better connection. I think when you look at the next steps and you look in the future, yes, I think the interface is going to be like the rabbit, like this the dash on your clothing, right? Like you can actually engage with. There is a reason why Sam Altman and OpenAI essentially purchase, I don't know, acquire the Johnny Ives company, right? Like an acquire, whatever, like, I don't know what accountants are inventing nowadays, but there is some structure, financial structure with Johnny Ive, because that's where the world is going clearly, right? And I think like, Ben, don't ask us, right? Like look at the younger folks, right? Like look at the 12-year-olds and see how they engage with this. They have a different engagement with computers. And last point on this recent study from Google showed, and you can look at this, by the way, they're, it's a publicly traded company, so you can see their papers. Search is down for Google, but voice search is up. Voice search via all those smart speakers and the phone is up. So, and it's up mainly in the younger demographics, meaning the engagement is becoming different.
Oh, that's really interesting. And I feel like we're going to completely go on this tangent. I'm going to briefly loop back a sec. So you mentioned obviously your company, and you're concentrating on front end at the moment. Why don't, if you could just tell us a little bit about what that offer is, and then maybe it sounds like you were alluding to that you move into kind of other verticals as part of that in the future. Is that sort of your vision?
Yeah. So where we operate, let's talk about the for a second, the space we operate in, right? So the space we operate in is working with software companies that has production code, that has an offering out there from that aspect. And essentially, if you look at today, the process of creating software, you have engineers in the middle. You probably have designers, product people, and then engineers at the end that are developing the software. And engineers essentially are utilizing different AI tools, right? They're using Copilots and Cursor and a bunch of other things to accelerate their performance. What autonomy AI essentially build is we build a mechanism that can mimic or learn the entire code base of an organization within a couple of minutes. And essentially on top of this, we have an agentic workflow that mimics an engineer. So just give you a little bit of a background where we operate. And the first step we launch is, yes, is autonomous front-end. So taking all the front-end work that a company has, right, and do and provide and generate the outcome very easily just with natural language, English, right? Like today we support on the English. There are other languages there, yeah, but like sure, English sure, sure. Is the yeah. is the main input language
it's
right now.
It's unfortunate that most coding languages is English, yeah. right?
Yeah. But where we're trying to take this, this and where we're starting to go is we're helping companies, and by companies, I mean VP R&D, CTOs, CEOs of companies to reimagine the way they produce their product, right? So that's kind of in a very broad level. So when you look at the software creation, right, you have like, roughly speaking, two main components to it, right? You have essentially the engine, the back end, where all the logic is being built, right? If you're a cybersecurity product or you're an analytics product, that's where you do all the big calculations and the IP. And then the front end, essentially everything you touch within the product, right? It's the manifestation, if you will, of the logic of the product itself. And that's like the UI, the user interface, when where people are clicking. So autonomy operates in the space of, hey, like we help you as an organization to accelerate and essentially just outsource this entire front-end creation to AI based on agents that are, and we kind of deliver and mimic a front-end engineer in the process itself. So your listeners probably heard about tools like Ball.new or Lovable and bunch of others. And essentially those tools are great to do something if you're an individual or you want to build a prototype, right? You want to go ahead and raise money. You have a great new idea. You go ahead and use one of those tools and you have a mock or a prototype for that matter. The problem, those platforms are not scalable in a company environment, in a production grade code, quote unquote. When you have thousands of users, when you have thousands of lines of code already, and that's what autonomy unique selling point. We know we build a product that can actually knows how to operate this kind of environment. We understand how the organization kind of build the code and we engage with it and we deliver really good results on top of it.
And does, I feel like you might have a preference, like when you're actually working with your service, does it have a preference towards a certain technology stack? Does it work better in React and less good in something? You know what I mean? Does it do any of that, or is it not really been a problem?
I think it's a great question. So let's think about the way we kind of like build the technology. As I mentioned, we learn the code base itself, right? So we mimic a human being. A human being can't possibly know all the code languages, and we want to be very accurate. So we work mainly on React Native, and Vue. There is a front-end kind of framework called Angular, which is like the old-school one. Most of the projects we're doing actually are... people are trying to move away from Angular to the more modern, I should say, frameworks. Yeah. and they're utilizing us to accelerate this process. But that's kind of what guided us. We want to learn in depth, like what possibly can be like done or what the code is look like, and then kind of engage with it.
Mm-mm-mm. Yeah, those people are probably incumbent, like they made their stuff like 10 years ago or something like that, and the Angular was the thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I was in it. I was deep in the trenches at that point, going.
We so, can be young forever.
Yeah, well, not currently. I guess I haven't had anyone on the podcast so far who's had, you know, invested time and effort and money into longevity stuff. But maybe if you're that person, let me know. So you're starting at the front end. Why the front end, and then what's going to happen to change to do more back end stuff? Because it feels like, you know, if someone's listening to this and going code, right? Maybe, or you just have this specific sector that you're focused on, and then, you know, you can broaden out from that. That's more of a strategic plan rather than a technology plan, if it were.
Yeah. So it's a great question. Let's again reiterate, we work in an organizational capacity. We work with companies, right? So let's talk about the pragmatic aspect of it. The pragmatic aspect is roughly, if you talk with most companies, 60 to 70% of the work is in the front end. Most of the QA is being done there. That's kind of like the issue. And someone once defined it, it's a necessary evil, right? If like CEOs, CTOs of company could build a product, they want to build the core, they want to build the logic behind it, and then the front end is the front end, whatever, right? I know there are a lot of front end engineers out there that's like it's an art for them, I totally get it, but when you think about it from an organizational capacity, when you want to build a business very fast, that's something like most businesses wouldn't like focus on that, at least at the beginning, right? It's like it's a Maslow pyramid of needs. You want to get your product out there first.
Okay, yeah.
So for us, it was like it answered the question of sense of urgency. This is something like we look at. This is something we need. This is the first thing we're going to do. The second thing, which is a very pragmatic reason as well, it was easier for us from a security perspective to penetrate the company. When we came in the beginning, we said, hey, we want to look at the code base here and kind of like build a semantic representation of it. People told us, before we call the police, get out of here, right? And I'm like, oh, okay, we hear you. We also understand what we said. When you look at front end, it was easier for us to pass the security reviews and to penetrate companies. And the third part, which is like pragmatic, but it's also served the bigger purpose of this. When we start building the front end, we start learning about the front end, we have more ability to kind of like look at the code from a different perspective, start analyzing and put different tracking pixels on the code itself. And then it's going to be easier for us to kind of like move downstream to the QA part of things, and then move downstream to the logic and the backend as well, and build a full application. So the overall vision of what we're imagining as a company is, yes, there's like this roughly two buckets of front end and back end where you build the application. There are users for the product, and those users are engaging with the product, and they see different drop points, and they have different feedback loops. We want to kind of build the entire feedback loop completely. So when a user is engaging with the product itself, and we're talking about masses, we're talking about like 10,000 users see a drop point in a specific place, we have in an autonomous way to kind of rewrite the ticket and engage with the front end first, and then change the logic in the back when we need it. So that's kind of like the logic and how we kind of imagine this, and we're less than a year away from in like releasing those kind of products to the market.
Yeah. I mean, that's really interesting. Like, it gives me, so in my world, there's, we have this idea that we test stuff. And this is like, I do lots of games development as well as AI stuff at the moment. And you test it with the audience, right? In a similar way that you're describing, right? And they give you answers back, which are that there are issues, but their solutions may not be the correct solutions. So it's interesting that you might find that people autonomously, that your system flags that people are dropping off at certain points, but you can't get the right answers from the people, right? They are dropping off.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that, you know, at that point, do you then need a person to step in and go, they could be dropping off for this reason, go and do this, you know, AI stuff and fix that for that reason? Or does the AI initiate that itself and make a decision why people might be dropping off?
The AI will initiate this in itself, right? So the mechanism would learn and understand. I'll give you an example of what we already see in the product today. So we launched the product in April, like what, 3.5 months ago, growing rapidly. We have tens and tens of clients already working on the platform. And one of the behaviors we started seeing, and that wasn't intended at the beginning, right? It was kind of like a side effect that we now productize. People are starting to asking us, hey, I have this sidebar and we have a drop there, like manually today. What should I do? How would you reimagine the design of it? And basically autonomy is generating the result. So, and it started to go, it started to take a very interesting turn when people are like, okay, I need to build a sidebar that will do 1, 2, 3 and answer 1 to 3 KPIs. How would you build it? And autonomy builds and like contextually to their design system, to their look and feel, build the sidebar itself, right? And all of a sudden, that was the initial vision from the beginning, but it happened faster than we thought. So we're like, okay, people are starting to engage with it. That's my comment in the beginning, right? And when I said that's what AI for me, like the ability to actually converse with something, that's what I see on a day-to-day basis. Now, let's take it in the capacity we just talked about. If you have tens of thousands of users that are engaging, there is no way for the human brain to kind of like digest this and understand what's going on, right? So you might look at Mixpanel or different analytics tools of engagement with your product. That's great. But then you will have, I don't know, roughly 20 different conclusions and then roughly 20, and you'll be biased to specific thing. And maybe you read something in the morning and you would think that's what's happening to you, right? It happens to everyone. It's legit. So AI is very deterministic, and it could come in and say, hey, I'm very pragmatic, I'm very deterministic, and this is what's happening, and I'm looking at the different kind of use cases and case studies and learning everything, and that's how you should fix it, right? The challenge, still the challenge is, would be how can you make it a little bit more creative? So AI is deterministic, but not creative. The creativeness comes with like how you guided the beginning. That's kind of like the full scope.
Yeah. Are you allowed to tell us kind of how it works? Can we get into the weeds a bit about the technology that you're using? Is it, because for me, the question is more around like, are you using other people's models? Are you using your models? Are you training things? Are you using a mixture of things? How does all that work? Or can you tell us as much as you
can? I'm happy to. So there are two main kind of parts to the product. Right, two main engines. One engine is what we call ACE, an agentic context engine, that runs on the code base that you probably know, MCP. And so it's MCP on steroids, something we build in-house. And that part essentially is LLM guided algorithms. We build an algorithm that can build a semantic representation of the code base, basically creates a mirror of the code base itself and analyze it, break it down to different vectors, ways that like we can digest in a better way. And the LLM that is guiding is like it varies. Right now it's Opus, right? But it varies like Anthropic Opus, but it varies between LLMs. And then the vectors are feeding essentially 5 agents that are mimicking front end engineer. So it's everything from the ability to actually read the code in a good way to create the UI all the way down to actually test it in real time. And those agents are pretty cool. And the reason they're pretty cool is because we build an infrastructure that we work on. And essentially we looked at a specific project, a specific code base. And once we do the first couple of iterations, we kind of learn what are the gaps, and the agent itself rewrite the prompt to actually optimize the end result. So if at the beginning you get a result that is like helping you save 70% of your workload in a ticket, at the 20th run, you'll be 90% time saved, because we learn and we kind of like, we have an agentic workflow that runs. It runs basically 3 times, sometimes even more. But it looks at the input you brought in, and then we have the ability to actually analyze the output from a visual perspective and see, okay, does it matches the input? Does it matches all the components that you wanted to have here? Yes, no, it doesn't. I'm going to do another loop and basically find different components or add different components. And then once we learn the behavior of the project, we can actually rewrite the prompts from the LLM perspective. The other cool part of this is the agents self decide the LLM or the model. So they have a lot of fun with it. Like we don't tell it what to do. It's very interesting because it's self-optimized and we had to build something generic. Think about it. Think about the code bases out there. It's like everyone writes in a different way, in a different perspective. Yes, like you have React, you have different engines, Vite, and you use MUI, Material UI, Shatsien. Yes, they're all like big buckets. But inside those big buckets, there are like millions of iterations. It's crazy. So how do you do it, right? How do you approach it? You need to have something that is kind of quote unquote alive and kind of self-sustained. So the agents understand the result, and we build a very good tool to help them assess the quality of the result itself. And then the second part, they kind of rewrite the LLM, but they also decide what LLM they're using. So right now they like, it's kind of funny that I talk about it that way now, I'm listening to myself right now. Right now they like Claude 4 and Gemini 2.5. Grok 4 just came out. No bueno. You can read this on our website. Like we had a result. It did a very bad job in terms of what it generates. But yeah, that's kind of like the high level mechanism of what we build inside.
Yeah. So are those agents, are those like some sort of internally trained, Llama variant, or like what are those agents?
So it's agentic workflows that we build internally, right? And we kind of like build the entire workflow for them. And they train the goal, and I think the key point, and we're really agentic workflow, not LLM wrapper or really good workflow for LLMs, really agentic workflow. It's a self-sustained agent, right? And it's a self-creation. Everyone here, maybe, I don't know if everyone of your listeners, but most of the people heard about Cursor. And the cool thing about Cursor and the real interesting thing about companies like Cursor is essentially Cursor is building Cursor, right? So it's understanding like the results, and it's optimized to Ben's needs. And it's the same thing that we've built in-house. Our agents, the UI agent, we call it the magician. The magician builds itself on your project. So it learns the different gaps and kind of adapts to the different results. So to answer your point, yes, it's a model that trains itself, and we kind of like expand it, but we don't build the model at the moment. We just help him build tools, right? So think about a kid that you have, and it learns, like it goes to first grade, and then like it gets more tools. So it learns how to write and read. And then in second grade, you're getting pretty better at math and like basic calculus. And by the fifth grade, you can do more things, and you can like be self-sustained and learn other things without the teacher coming to you and saying, hey, you should learn this. So this is the same way we kind of imagine in the product we're building.
Right. So they have lots of flexibility in what, they produce, as long as it's the fitness has to exist somewhere, right? So you have to like go, this is good code, this is bad code somewhere. So I'm presuming you have a load of code that you've scraped from somewhere. I don't know if we're getting to the weeds too much about this, because it almost feels like maybe you can talk about that if you want to. But I would also like to cover, because this is the Machine Ethics Podcast, how do you feel about because some people could imagine that your product and lots of other products, like let's be fair, are eroding certain aspects of the job market, right? So you are literally taking away work from front-end developers. And then there were other people who would say, well, we're accelerating the creation of front-end. We're enabling people to do more. And it might be that we get more front-end done, and therefore there's more work there in the aggregate. Do you have kind of an idea of how your company and how you will maybe progress will fit into this kind of dialogue?
Yes, but I want to ask you a question. Does it matter? So, right? because the way I look at this, our disposition is we want to help front-end engineers essentially focus on like the core, right? The logic. That's our disposition. I think it doesn't matter what I say. And I think it doesn't matter like what other people say that are coming from this field. At the end of the day, when you look at the capitalist market and when you look at someone who's building a company, the basic thing for every mediocre CEO or a company leader, if you can do more with less, that's something you will try to do, right? Yeah. At the end of the day. So I think at the bottom line, what we are seeing, what we are intending to do is we want to help engineers essentially focus on logic and take all the busy work from them. Effectively, what's happening and what's going to happen, not just with autonomy, right, with other companies as well, is the ability for companies to say, okay, I can actually save here, or I can actually move faster. I need less workforce. I need different workforce, right? Mm-hmm. I think Mark Benioff said it in the most like American way possible. It's like, it's a good way to reallocate your workforce, right? And I'm like, okay, that's interesting.
I mean, where are you reallocating them to? Like, that's the question, isn't it? It's like, that's a nice sentiment, but it's like, cool, are they doing other interesting important things, or what's going on here? I mean, I think my position on this stuff is both kind of stark and also hopeful, right? Because you could be hopeful that all this stuff brings in a renaissance of the ability to dream of new things and make them and hopefully create wealth and, you know, hopefully well-being in the world. And the other way of looking at it is our world is not ready for that, and it's all going to come crashing down really quickly. So I think... I'm kind of like teetering on the edge of this sort of thing.
I think it's a good point, but let's do a quick history lesson for a second, right? Mm-hmm. I think the other big revolution that happened was the Industrial Revolution. And if you think about the Industrial Revolution, what happened immediately after, short term was horrendous, but what happened immediately after, essentially psychoanalysis came to life, Freud came to life, right? And all of a sudden people had more time, and the self became something that people could actually practice, right? And if you look like a few years later, right, and the professions that came out after World War II, which was horrendous, right, globally, like it was an insane shakeup for the world, but like all of a sudden people started looking at things differently, and like all of a sudden children became children. That's when people started to treat children as a children bracket, and kind of humanity evolved from those kind of things. Yes, it was like a big, big impact. I'm with you. I think the short term though is going to be not great, right? I think like a lot of things, like, because that's what happens. Like when humanity moves in big waves, like short term is not going to, it's not going to be great. But I think in the longer term, it's going to open up more resources. And we're thinking about it like from a very Western perspective, right? We're thinking about it from people who sit in like very advanced economies. But think about the abilities that could help people in Africa, right? All of a sudden, access to an internet can help them actually build companies that could go global. I actually talked with a few entrepreneurs from Nigeria and from Kenya, and they're starting thinking about those kind of things. It was very nice to see and great to see this, because it's essentially democratizing a lot of things. So yes, like short-term companies like Autonomy, yes, I would say this, but like even companies like Cursor, for example, which like they're, maybe take a step back, Cursor, for example, only senior engineers are being trusted to use it. When you look at like the hiring, the job market for junior people, it's very hard. Like a recent study showed that like if sometimes junior Ivy League junior grads in computer science used to take like 6 months to find a job, now it's a year and a half. So it's it's even creating an impact right now, right? So yes, short term, it's going to create a big impact. But guess what? Those junior individuals will find a different way to build companies. They will build companies in a faster way. I have a 9-year-old son. He works with different vibe coding tools, and he builds websites right now. He's trying to figure out different things. I'm not helping him. And I'm like, man, he's starting to think about those kind of things. It's going to be very interesting.
I think I'm going to leave you with your optimism, and I won't burden you with my pessimism. So during this whole process, I feel like the whole agent nature, or agentic AI, or agent-based AI, or what is it? I think when we first came in, it was called Oh, what was it called? It was auto AGI.
Yeah.
So we have all these things, like, you know, things move fast over the last couple of years, of course. But do you have any words of wisdom for people who are interested in agentic AI things, and words of you know, things that can go wrong, and you know,
So first of
yeah.
all, I'm not a big believer in AGI. I think like people are like, it's funny how the voices have started to change in the last 6 months, right? It's like all of a sudden AGI, you hear about it way less, right? It's because all of a sudden it's like what happened with Microsoft and OpenAI and what Microsoft had mentioned about AGI, and I think what agents and agentic workflow is trying to do is kind of like not bring AGI to life, but it's more focused test. Base, test-based AI, right? And I think that's a different aspect of this. So, what agents can do is essentially build more guardrails to the AI process and be more task-oriented, right? They can be self-evolve and they can be proactive in terms of those kind of things, meaning think about things before you think about them. But in their own guardrails, which is like, which is the cool part, right? And the way agent works is you give them essentially like a point that you need to go, right? Like a tenfold that they need to reach, and that's what they do. They can self-evolve, but in this spectrum, unlike the rumors about AGI when it's like off the rails and self-learning and all those kind of things. And I think like. You can hear it more and more that people are or actually not hear it. People are not talking about AGI. I think the super intelligence or safe super intelligence like Ilya Sutskever, ex OpenAI, that's what people are starting to talk about more, right? More guardrails to AI. But the guardrails to AI, and that's something that it's a very clear nuance, are guardrails around tasks. Within the task, you can get more evolution, right? But it's not going to be like willy-nilly, I can do whatever I want, connect to a random computer and learn from it.
Right. So you give them quite contained ability to do stuff. You know, you might have access to so much resource. Like you can only do this so much, for example. You could only access certain websites, maybe. You can only you know, execute so much a certain code and things like that. Because I mean, one of the things that agentic AI gives you is the ability to, like, it has a result and it can run that code and it can then, or like, have access to all these different kind of APIs and different bits that you give it access to, and then it can work within those systems. So is there an opportunity to make the wrong call on that, and then and make the wrong task, and then do we get paperclip maximizers at that point, or is that sort of like it, so far away from where we are currently?
No, so I think we need to talk about it from two aspects, right? We need to talk about it from the aspect of safety and like how safe it is in terms of the hallucinations we're generating. And I think that, funny, like everyone probably heard about the story about Grok, for example, right? So there are different tests. By the way, you heard the way they want to mitigate this. I think it's crazy. I think if you ask Grok now controversial questions, it will refer to what Elon Musk had to say in media and different, like in social media. I'm not sure. Maybe it's better, Let's go back to the Grok who's answering like neo-Nazi answers and different things. Like, I'm not sure what's better. But that's the way they try to deal with it. So there's the safety aspect and then there's the quality aspect. The safety aspect, I feel like, is more relevant to what like consumers are consuming, right? Like the way you engage with it. And I think there it's up to the like it's not a matter of like guardrails or sorry, it's a matter of guardrails. It's not a matter of like AGI and could be self-taught. It's essentially it's the model is a deterministic model, right? Like what you bring in, it's the output you will get, like in a very simple-minded way to describe it. The context you will provide, that's the context you will get. And companies can put guardrails to it. The guardrails that companies like LLM providers like Anthropic or OpenAI will put there won't hurt the evolution of the model, right? It will just put guardrails. So I think it's a matter of choice. Mm-hmm. From a B2B perspective, from a professional perspective, the agents, the agentic workflows are actually helping increase quality and build trust, right? So if you think about how an organization is working today, if I'll go ahead and put code inside an LLM, I'll get a decent result, but it won't be contextual and high quality to what I need as a business. And agentic workflow kind of build those guardrails and build the right context aspect. Mm-hmm. And if you do a good enough job in building the right context aspect, context window to it, mm-hmm. you will get a good result. So the training part from that aspect is like, in both cases, are guardrails, right? Like, where do you put the guardrails and put the focus and like the North mm-hmm. Star for the agent to actually engage? And for the consumer perspective is like, if you decide not to do those kind of things, right? Grok didn't hallucinate. Grok just didn't have guardrails around those topics. It's very simple, right? So I think that's a key aspect to it.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it is fascinating that if people didn't see that Grok episode, it started calling itself Mega Hitler or something.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. So in its responses to questions, it would say, as Uber Hitler or something like that, I think this. And it's like, what is going on here? And it's obviously gone down a training hole of suspect training material, I would suggest, maybe. Yeah, and like you said, like maybe the guardrails weren't quite specific enough for that. Yeah, so I'm presuming you're not going to have that kind of problem because you're obviously focused on code for a start. Do you think that you have to bring in some of your own guardrails in respect to that first element of using other people's models to scan that sort of thing? Or is that kind of like you're not asking it to do anything kind of too unusual? It's not going to be so much of an issue.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have to share something. And I think like if you put a man or a person with a machine, mm-hmm. it's very interesting, the conversations that are happening. So yes, we are generating code. We're enabling at the end of the code generation to ask for changes on the code. Sure. But the inputs sometimes we're getting there are not code related and are very interesting, like are very strange, right? It's like not just foul language like in general, but like weird. I'm not sure if I can like share some things, right? Like,
maybe not quite the specific
words. We had more than once someone asked to write the code as if the same way as if I were on drugs. And I'm why? Yeah. Why would you? And it happened more than once and not with a specific individual. So to answer your question, I think if you put someone again with the machine in like a confined space, some very weird things will come out.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it surprised me. So to answer your question, yes, we need to put guardrails there. Like we need to tame the beast. And in that case, the beast is the person. It's not the machine.
Yeah, yeah. It's the beast is the whole system, including the person.
So I'm like, okay, so what can you actually ask? Because the LLM and the agent will answer specific things. And by the way, it did a pretty good job. But it's scanner depends on the drugs of choice, right? But if it's scanner,
wow,
like this is very strange. Okay, so that's the first guardrail. I think like in terms of the first aspect, we kind of like need to build a mechanism to be more guided, and kind of say that's an input we can deal with. That's an input we can actually digest, for lack of better words, and that's an input like now. We don't know what to do with it. Like, ask a different question. The user experience of what like people are used to from AI today, when AI, you converse with AI and AI is answering about everything, is lacking. It's less better, but like also asking those kind of questions. I'm like, I don't know why. So.
No, it's really interesting because it's one of those things where people might not be aware. There's all these different places where you can kind of alter things, but add things during that whole process. And I feel like going back to the Grok circumstance, that they must have added things in the training process, which were, you know, things which they weren't picking up post inference. So like, you have this training, and then, well, you have data, you put it into this model, and by put it in, I mean you do lots of processing with the data to move towards certain aspects of what the data represents, and then you can do post-training. But then also, when someone asks a question, you can just say no, like you've said this word, and I'm not going to let you.
Yeah,
it's not going to fly. I'm not even going to even pass it on to the LLM. And then you get this kind of post thing where the LLM said this thing, and it's not great. I'm not going to let the user see this response.
Yeah.
So there's all these different kind of places where you can do stuff. And what you're saying is, also at your end, you're saying there's this other place where unusual things happen, and we need to think about that.
Yeah, I think people would be people. That's what people do, right? They want to engage with those kind of things. It's
they want to push the envelope and try things out, don't they? Yeah.
By the way, if you ever tried in DeepSeek to put in like questions about Taiwan or Tiananmen Square or things like this, you know, you don't get an answer. It's like, I'm not sure it's accurate. Those kind of things. But like you heard a year ago, I think it was last summer or two summers ago, they put it like in Times Square in New York, where I live, right? They put like a virtual gate to Dublin in Ireland. It was always on with two cameras in, and you could see people walking around in Dublin, and you could see people walking around Times Square. They took it off after 3 days. It's like even in the center of the world, like as Americans call it, in Times Square, right? It's like people did very interesting things. So that's the same thing with LLMs, especially when you're like in a private environment. I would say it's not that hard to resolve it, right? Like when you train a model, you can add ethics to the model itself and what you can do, right? If you go ahead and write, because the information is out there. If you want to build a good model, the information is out there. It trains a lot of like online data and a lot of online information in different forums, right? If you use Perplexity, it looks at Reddit, looks at a bunch of other things, right? And then you need to put guardrails against this. So if you ask the LLM, hey, how can I build a bomb? It'll probably say no, because there are guardrails to it. So the ethics, it's actually a good point, right? It's like, what's the north? If agents has a north star of like, what they can achieve in specific guardrail, I think LLMs, which is a broader, way broader thing, should have a conscience and ethics of like what they want to talk about, right? And hey, if you're as an individual want to go and talk about like things that are not specifically PG rated, I would say to the least, or ethical as most humanity, you can use different LLMs that like allow it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned DeepSeek earlier. There was an article I saw that had, I think there was like 50 kind of ethical tests that they might run on a model, which is kind of like well known. And it's things like that bomb thing, right? You know, you ask an LLM, how do you make this very specific homemade bomb? And it will go, I'm sorry, but I can't give you that information, yada, yada, yada. Whereas DeepSeek failed on all of these counts. And it's like, oh yeah, you just do it like this. It's great. Go for it, guys.
Yeah.
Knock yourself out.
Taiwan, no bueno, but mom, yeah.
Well, exactly, and part of the situation is that these services, these companies, these institutions are making those decisions about how they train these things and how they. So obviously, the DeepSeek guys were in China. It feels like they, with the Taiwan stuff, is like they make conscious a decision there, right?
100%.
I'm presuming there's a constant decision there, in the same way that OpenAI and all the Perplexity would make a conscious decision to do certain things. But also, you can just like forget, you could just not do stuff, which is also bad. Like, you know, the whole bomb thing feels like they just went, we'll just put it out. don't worry about it. Which is obviously another worrying aspect, which I'm sure my listeners have heard me bang on about many times before. But it's interesting, isn't it, where those kind of decisions lie, and with the Grok thing recently, it's almost like that there's an unknown decision that someone made. They didn't realize it was going to have this kind of catastrophic, weird outcome in that way.
I mean, it's really, I don't want to be cynical, but it's a good PR stunt, if you ask me. At the end of the day, Grok 4 is coming out. That's the first thing that's coming out to the press, or the 1.5 thing that is coming out to the press after the initial release. Everyone is talking about that. They're fixing it very easily. I just think, sadly, it's a bad PR stunt, but it's like it's an effective PR stunt. You know?
Yeah, that's all PR's good PR situations, isn't it? Yeah, that's very interesting. If anyone knows about that, can they let us know? I wish we were in I feel like we need a phone in, like live stream version of this. Like, oh, actually, Janet is on the phone and she has told us that she works with Grok, and that would be excellent. So we're kind of getting towards near the end of the podcast. Is there something that we haven't chatted about yet that you'd like to kind of like discuss?
I think overall, like the main topic that I'm doing on a day-to-day basis is, it's how you can accelerate workflows in companies to get better results, right? Like we're focusing on software, but there are numerous solutions and companies. And what I would suggest to everyone, like from that topic, is like kind of challenge yourself, challenge your coworkers, try to find different ways, right? To kind of like use, not just use LLM as like an input or an output source, but actually try to challenge different applications that are out there. And I think it's like, it's scary at the beginning, but it could be effective and accelerate, like, first of all, open your horizon and accelerate the work that you're doing and help you focus on other things.
Wicked. Yeah. So the last question we always ask on the podcast, which some of this we might have talked about or a little bit already, but what is it that excites you and maybe scares you a little bit about our AI-mediated future?
The change, the fact that I'm seeing, like, I'm fortunate enough to have a kind of a front row seat to how the work environment is changing with the AI aspect. And I think it excites me a lot, because like the optimistic side of me says, well, we're going to venture to new horizons as a human race, right? It's also very scary, right? If you think about it, and it's like, go back to my 9-year-old son. He's like, hey, Dad, I want to go learn computer science. I'm like, plumber. It's going to be, short term, it's going to be way more effective than computer science. And he's like, oh, okay. So that part scares me. And not being a plumber at all, but the part of like, it's unknown, right? Some paradigms are unknown.
Yes. Yeah. I think someone else said be a plumber recently, actually. But I mean, there's going to be certain practical jobs, which there's going to be a long tail of AI that will not be able to touch a lot of that stuff because robotics is not quite there yet. Yeah. But a lot of, like, I've been, in my career, web designer, teacher, you know, data science and design and coding teacher, and games developer, designer, and a lot of that stuff is going to change dramatically in the next couple of years, definitely, or is already changing. So, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Well, with that, thank you so much for being on the show. And how do people talk to you, follow you, find out about you? Go.
Yep. So first of all, thank you for having me on the show. It was great. I had a lot of fun. You can follow me on LinkedIn or connect on LinkedIn and reach out, Adir Ben Yehuda. And then if you want to check out Autonomy AI, it's autonomyai.io. Go check it out.
Yep. Awesome. I'm going to go check it out now and I will report back. Thank you very much for coming on the show and I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome to the end of the episode. Thank you so much to Adir for coming on and talking to us about a plethora of stuff, his company, LLMs, how they are used, what his vision is for his company, and just the web and jobs in general. I think my pessimism was kind of clear from our conversation, but it's nice that Adir had this optimism to kind of balance me out a little bit there. Towards the end, I think it's bonkers that we keep having this conversation about what is practical for us to be doing I wish we weren't getting to that point where we are scrabbling around for the scraps. It feels like knowledge workers are doomed, and this kind of AI erosion of our workforce and things like that. I'm hoping that we have a more hopeful vision going forward. So hopefully I can talk to someone about that soon. Be that as it may, I'm hoping that you're doing well and still able to make ends meet, and that we can go forward and hopefully make a vibrant ecosystem of things that we like doing, things that drive us forward as a society and a human race, and all that sort of great kind of blue sky thinking, moonshot stuff. Maybe I can put down my thoughts more succinctly in future. If you'd like to follow us and hear more from me, we can go to machine-ethics.net for more episodes of the podcast. And if you can, you can support us on patreon.com/machineethics. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.